captivity and coming back to the homeland as a resurrection, leaving there and coming back. The concept is not very clear. And even the concept in the Psalms, David said, "You'll not leave my soul into Sheol, nor suffer thy Holy One to see corruption," indicates some kind of a resurrection. But it was a shadowy kind of a thing. It wasn't a clear-cut understanding. Now that to me is strictly a New Testament doctrine from Christ Jesus. We're grateful for it. Well, all right. Now we come to the ninth of these generations. Now, first of all, the generations of the heavens and the earth, back in the second chapter, I believe, along somewhere. Then the generations of Adam. Then the generations of Noah. The generation of the sons of Noah. The generations of Shem. Then the generations of Ishmael. The generations of Isaac. The generation of Esau. Now we come to Esau here. Of Esau, I missed one back there. Esau and then Jacob. Ishmael and Isaac. Yeah, well, Ishmael and Isaac. All right. Let me run those by again. Not that it makes much difference. But the heavens and the earth, then Adam, and then Noah, sons of Noah, and Shem. Oh, Terah. Terah was one. Then the generations of Terah. Then the generations of Ishmael, the generations of Esau, Ishmael and of Isaac, and the generation of Esau and of Jacob. There are 10 of them. 10 of these generations in the book of Genesis. Some of them are very short. Some of them are more linked. That of Ishmael and of Esau are brief. Now we come to that of Esau, and although we'll not try to read all these names here, you can memorize that if you want to. I'm just going to pass over. I just want to note the lesson of this. Now, these are the generations of Esau. The son, the same as Edom. Esau took his wives of the daughters of Canaan. Ada, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite. Right? Now, here were Hittites in the group. And then down here, another is a Hivite. Now, the Hivite, then you come over to verse 20, here's a Horite. As the dwellers in caves, that word means. So you'll notice then that in Esau's genealogy, here are these Canaanites mixed up in that. Well, that was the reason why the Rebekah wanted to send Jacob back to Padan Aram to find a wife up there, because she didn't want him to take a wife of these Canaanites, these Hittites, as Esau had, for they were a sore thorn in her flesh. Yes. Well, he went and took some others trying to please. I don't know, may have. He's one of these, old Esau is a kind of a fellow that just sort of a, to me, he strikes me as a, the kind of a fellow that likes to hunt in the out of doors, and would not, a writer of Hebrews called him a profane person. That is one with a disregard for things sacred. He does not convince us. A fellow that you think of him as a man that likes to hunt and to fish in the out of doors, a kind of a careless, maybe happy-go-lucky sort of a fellow, didn't take these matters real seriously. And so he had got him some wives then, but his mother didn't like those, so he went and got him some more. She didn't like those any better. Now, whether he's trying to please or displease, I wouldn't know about that. But at any rate, he's that kind of a fellow here. All right? And now, so here is a genealogy, the generations of Esau here. Now notice down about, and Esau, verse 6, took his wives and his sons and his daughters and all the souls of his house and his cattle and all his beasts and all his possessions which he had gathered in the land of Canaan and went into a land away from his brother Jacob. Now, he couldn't have had all those possessions when Jacob left, for he hadn't had time. But my guess is he knew that God had promised him for an inheritance, this land of Canaan. Well, I'll get out of here before he gets back. And so he moves to Seir then, south of the Dead Sea, and begins to carve him out a nation down there. And I think he was probably on one of those trips when he came up to meet Jacob that we read about a while ago. All right? But at any rate, he wants to get away from him. Now, I'm sure he didn't wait until Jacob was on his way back or he heard that he was coming, and they have. He may have, when he heard he was coming, began to make that preface. That I don't know. But I do know that he got away from his brother Jacob. For their substance was too great for them to dwell together, And the land of their sojourners could not bear them because of their cattle. And Esau dwelt in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. Now, that seems to indicate that he actually didn't move out until Jacob was coming back. So you see, when he went to meet Jacob, Jacob then stopped at Sukkot, stayed there some time, came over to Shechem, spent some time there, came on down to Bethel, spent some time there, then came on down. Now, you might be able to go back and figure out about how long all this was from Isaac's age, 180 years. Now, if you're interested in that kind of a study, which I am, for don't have anything else to do. If I got something to learn worthwhile, I don't spend my time on that. But it would be as interesting if you've got that much curiosity. So you might work that out. But this latter expression seems to indicate to me that it was after he heard Jacob was coming back. And now this land had been given by Jehovah unto him. So I'll get out now while the getting is good. Doesn't that seem like it to you that that's his idea there? That seems to be the point there. All right, so Seir is south. Now that country was not as desolate, it seems, then as it was, now. It seems that at that time there were springs there and streams, such as here with the river Arnon, and there were other brooks and springs there. Right? And these are the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomite, and he goes on with that, in Mount Seir. And he goes on to continue to name them. You come on down here, we mentioned over here the Hittite over here, and now come on over here to the Horites in verse 20. Now these are the sons of Seir, the Horite. Now maybe these are the inhabitants of the land, because that means dwellers in caves. All right, now verse 31. And these are the kings that reigned in the land of Edom before there reigned any king over the children of Israel. All right, some of them might say, well, now wait a minute. Did Moses write this? Yes, Moses wrote this. Well, there a long time after Moses before they had a king, that's right. But in Deuteronomy 28, Moses said, when you shall appoint unto you a king over you. God foretold, he knew what they were going to do. He knew what eventually they'd do. And so Moses could say here that they had a king before Israel had a king. Because Israel had no king when they came in. These could have had kings before. And so when he wrote this, so he knew that these kings would come. Now I'm dropped down to verse 39. And here, Baal-Hanan, the son of Achbor, died, and Hadar reigned in his stead. And the name of the city was Pau, or whatever you want to call it. That indicates this last individual here might still, Achbor died, Hadar reigned in his stead, but there's nothing about the death of this Hadar. So it may be that Hadar was the king ruling in Edom when Moses and the children of Israel tried to come in and pass through there. So no mention of his death. That's just a suggestion. Followed out for what it may be worth. Now in verse 40, here are the names of the chiefs according to the places. That is of residence. Now these are the names of the chiefs that came of Esau according to their families after their places by their names. All right, now here he goes on into that where they... the land where they would live, did live. So you have then the generation here, but I think the main thing is, since God promised Esau that he would make of him a nation, let me go back and look at that, back in that 34th, that chapter rather, where he, where Isaac blessed him here. All right, it's in chapter 25, yeah, verse 23, isn't it? No, a little further. What did you say that chapter was? Where was that? A little farther over here. Yeah, over in chapter 27. All right, chapter 27 here. And he's given the blessing here. He gives the blessing there, verses 28, 27 to 30, that 29, unto Jacob. Now, when Esau came in, over here in verse 39, that's what I'm looking for, Esau lifted up his voice and wept. And Isaac his father answered and said unto him, behold, of the fatness of the earth shall be thy dwelling, and of the dew of heaven from above. And by thy sword shalt thou live, and thou shalt serve thy brother. And it shall come to pass, when thou shalt break loose, that thou shalt shake his yoke from off thy neck. Now, that took place under some of the kings of Judah much later. Now, David and some of those kings subdued the Edomites, but later on, I forget the king that they revolted under. They revolted under one and shook off that yoke there. I should shake off the yoke, but the point I'm making is, he gives him a blessing here of material facts. All right, so this is the blessing that he would receive. So now here he made a big strong nation, many descendants, takes this land and will dwell in the fat of it, but live by the sword. I think that indicates not a spiritual man. He wasn't a spiritual man. He was a man of the world. I'd think of him today as just an average man of the world, a worldly fellow. Concerned with certain things, but not concerned with the spiritual. In fact, the gods of the Edomites are mentioned. I've never found but one or two times they were ever mentioned. The gods of these other Canaanites are mentioned often, but not of these. Now, I heard a man lecture a good many years ago, the man who had discovered the high place of Petra. Now, they had discovered Petra, but he discovered the high place of Petra there. Now, whether that was built by the Edomites or built by the Nabataeans, I don't really know. Nobody else seems to. All right. Now, let me pause there a minute. I think I'm going to stop there because when we come to Jacob and the things over here in him, I want to start with him next time. Because now we come to the tenth of these generations or histories. Now here is the generations of Jacob. And Jacob dwelt in the land of his father's sojourning, in the land of Canaan. Now these are the generations of Jacob. All right? And so he goes on and tells us that Joseph was 17 years old at that time. All right? So that we can figure out. Now if you're interested in these ages and all of that, makes a very interesting study. If you want to try to work it out, and you're mathematically minded and all that, got a good calculator, well, you can figure it out. But I think we'll stop there. Because this lesson tonight is not as exciting as some of the lessons are. And torn maybe to kind of lose interest just a little bit long from place to place. But anyway, we come now to some interesting things. Now, chapter 13 is a chapter filled with God. Chapter 38 is another chapter filled with sin. And then chapter 39 is one also in which you see God honored in it. So we'll try to cover chapters 37, 8, 9, and 40 next time. I'm trying to cover as many chapters as I can. And you want to meet next time? What is next time? 18th? Is that Christmas week? Still want to meet, do you? Oh, that's good. I'm not going to, it don't take me long to open my Christmas presents. I don't have to start that night. So we'll see you next time, sir. And I don't keep up. We have no idea. All right. Anyway, I think we have about 31 or 2 tonight. One boy had to leave. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I thought it's about 31 or 2 of us. He came back in. So about 32. Thank you for coming. We'll see you next time, and we'll try to cover the 4 chapters if it runs a little longer than tonight. So the class is excused. Seven. to what to me is the most interesting and fascinating section of the book of Genesis. That's all been interesting. But in our lesson tonight, the 37th, 8th, 9th, and 5th, 10th, I'm going to cover the 40th chapter, about 3 or 4 chapters. But in this, we have everything that goes to make up an interesting story and study, or a drama, whatever you want to call it. We have the good fellows, and we have the bad ones, bad guys. We have intrigue, we have deception, we have the victory and the triumph of what is right, and all of that. I think we have so many things in this section here that go to make a fascinating and interesting story. Now, by story, I mean a historical story, the story of historical events. Exciting, really. Most of this is, and the excitement of any study, I think, usually depends on the teacher, whether or not the teacher can get into it and make it bring out of the lesson what's in it, and I'll try to do that tonight. Now, chapter 37, and Jacob dwelt in the land of his fathers, of father's sojournings, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Now, as I said in the very beginning, there are 10 of these generations, or we might translate it histories, history of certain individuals. That was, first of all, the generations of the heavens and the earth. That was back in chapter 2, I believe. Then the generations of Adam, the generations of Noah, the generations of the sons of Noah, the generations of Shem. Then the next 5 of them were the generations of Terah, the generations of Ishmael, the generations of Isaac, the generations of Esau, and now the generations of Jacob. Now, this section is 15 chapters that we'll get entering into tonight. This is the longest one, I think, 15, something like that. Maybe 14 or 15 chapters. At any rate, it's by far the longest of all of these sections that we're studying. Now, the one that dealt with Ishmael and the one that dealt with Esau were very brief. But at any rate, we have these 10 histories, and this is the division that Moses himself gives to his book. Now, ordinarily, when I used to teach it, I would divide it up entirely in a different division from that. And you may. But this is his division. And that's what we're trying to follow in this particular study. And now, also in this section that we're studying tonight, it seems that Joseph takes precedence over all others, and yet really he doesn't. It's the generations of Jacob. We still have Jacob before us, and we are following the promise made to Jacob and what God was doing. So we won't lose sight of that. Also, don't lose sight, as you're going through Genesis, of the promise made in Eden to the woman, that I put enmity between the devil, right, between thee and the woman, thy seed and her seed. He shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Now, this is a theme that's developed all the way through. So then we come on down to Abraham, and God starts in with him, "In thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed." So then we're tracing and developing this promise made unto the woman, and now then unto Abraham, and renewed unto Isaac, and renewed unto Jacob as he was fleeing into Padan Aram. So this is the thing that you're looking for in this book. It's actually a development of the promise of the coming Messiah. That's really the theme of all the Old Testament, and the thing that one must ever keep before him. And whatever God does is looking down on it to the fullness of time, when he will bring his son into the world, born of the woman, a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then in our last lesson, when we come to the 49th chapter, here it's narrowed down now to one of the tribes, the tribe of Judah. Then in 2 Samuel, it narrows down to a family, the family of David. And so this is what we are looking for, and really the key theme of our book. I remember when I was a boy, I heard a man preach, and he talked about the scarlet thread. Ran all the way through the Bible. Well, I went home and got down my mother's Bible, looked for a scarlet thread. I couldn't find it. That's how ignorant I was of what he was talking about. Because what he meant was that the blood lineage there and the thread there that led to the sacrifice. But you won't find anybody any more ignorant of the Bible than I was when I was growing up. I knew my mother taught us right from wrong, but a lot of the rest of it I didn't learn. Right, now, this is the generation then of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren, and he was a lad with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah. Now, these are the two handmaids, and he was with these two each, the two sons of each of these. Hard men, they're young men, but they were hard, quite wicked. His father's wives. And Joseph brought the evil report of them unto his father. Now, these boys, what they did, he came and told the father about it. Is that complimentary of Joseph, or isn't it? It might have been, it might not have been. Maybe he was thinking of his own self-righteousness, and I'm so much better than they are, and I'm more spiritual than all. Maybe he was thinking like that. I don't know. He turns out to be a fine fellow. But I'm wondering if there wasn't a possibility that here he wanted to exalt himself in the eyes of his father at the price of his brothers. And it might have been some good cause for it. I don't know. At any rate, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a coat of many colors, or literally it means a long garment with sleeves, or a garment with long sleeves. Actually, translators do not know how to translate the word. And so some of them have made it one thing, many colors, and some of them a long sleeve or a long coat. At any rate, it was a unique coat. It was one that probably an important person would wear. And Jacob is showing his preference here for Joseph in doing that. Now, you'll learn a lot of lessons here. We'll learn the lesson from Jacob and his wives of the unhappiness of a polygamous home. We learn that. And these boys, we see them growing up wicked. I think that's the result of being reared in a polygamous home, where here was intrigue and here was differences here and here was jealousy and faction going on among the wives and the children, and the father here trying to sort of hold the thing together and unable to do it. So learn that. Now, I think you can learn here a lesson on the wrong or the danger of a parent showing partiality to one of his children. Now, I know my wife and I had five children, and Widner has two, making seven in all, but of the five children that we reared, I found it difficult not to show favoritism to one of them. Why? Because that one showed favoritism to me. He was the best one of the bunch in many ways, and I couldn't help but be a little, my wife said, I'm still partial to him. Well, maybe I am. I don't know. I try not to be, but I try never to show it. Don't ever show partiality to one of your children. Now, that's what he did. He made him a coat of many colors. Or it might have been a long coat, a long sleeve, whatever it was. And his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, and they hated him, and could not speak peaceably unto him. Notice that now. They hated him, and that's pointed out three times. And the hatred becomes intensified as you move along. And they could not speak peaceably. They just couldn't say anything good to him. They kind of disdained him in their conduct. All right, now, Joseph has two dreams here. Now, these dreams that occur here, Joseph's two dreams and the dreams of the butler and the baker and the dreams of Pharaoh, all play an important part here. Now, whether these dreams are divinely given or whether some of them are natural dreams that God makes something out of, I'll let you decide. They seem to me to be kind of a special dream in which, especially these two of Joseph, in which God has a hand in it. But some of those things I don't know, and I don't press them. Now Joseph dreamed this dream now, and he said unto them, hear, I pray you, this dream. Now just hear you. Now look what I dreamed. Look, you use that word two or three times in the original language. And he said unto them, hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, And lo, my sheep arose and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaves came round about and made obeisance to my sheep. Now, was any need of him particularly telling? Don't you think he got a lot of self-satisfaction out of that? I think he did. I think he shows here a little bit of a spirit, maybe not a little bit, but a spirit here of self-importance in this. The youngest one, spoiled by his father, no doubt he had one younger brother, but he's the one who'd been spoiled after these several years. And so he told him this dream, and all your sheaves did obeisance to mine, they bowed down to it. Well, that wasn't going to make the brethren think any more of him. You know that, but it looked like he delighted in that. And his brethren said to him, shalt thou indeed reign over us, or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us? Now you can see they're indignant over this. They got the point of the dream all right, that he would be over them and they would be recognizing that. And they hated him yet the more for his dreams, they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words, for what he said to them, and probably the way that he said it. And that, I think, is stands out here. But he dreamed again, and he dreamed yet another dream, and told it to his brethren, and said, behold, I have dreamed yet a dream, and behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars made obeisance to me. Now, this is even a little bit better than the other one, don't you see? And he can't wait to tell them this dream. He knew how it was going to affect them. And evidently his father hadn't heard the first one, seemingly. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him and said unto him, what is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee, to the earth? What do you mean by this dream? Now, the father even rebukes him for it. And I think the father saw in the attitude of Joseph here, and Joseph's a fine man, don't misunderstand, but remember, he's just a boy, 70 years old, and cocky, no doubt, and feels his importance, because his daddy gave him this coat, and his daddy favors him. So it wasn't good, all that wasn't. And later on, he has to go through a period here in this prison in which he had time to think. And I think rub out some of that spirit and feeling that he had. Some good lessons, I think, in this. And his brethren envied him, and his father kept the saying in mind. Now, back here you see in verse 4 they hated him. Verse 5 they hated him yet more. Down here in verse 8, and they hated him yet the more. That seems to be intensified even yet the more for these dreams. And now then they envied him. What does the word envy mean? It means to begrudge a person that which he has, doesn't it? We sometimes use the word envy and jealousy together, but they're entirely different. To envy one is to begrudge him that which he has or that which he is able to do. Jealousy is the fear of being supplanted in the affection of one by another, don't you see? And so the two words are entirely different, carry an entirely different idea. For a long time, I didn't know what the difference was. Finally, I went to the dictionary and found out. You know, that's always a good idea. You stumble along for years on something. You don't know anything about it. Then you say, well, let me go find out. It doesn't take long to find out. But we just don't do that. But they envied him. But his father kept the saying in mind. Now, you remember that was said of Mary and Jesus, that these things that were taking place, and she kept them in her mind, in her heart. So the father does. The father knew there was something to these dreams. Now, he knew there was going to be something there. He didn't know what, but he kept these things in his mind. All right? And his brethren went to feed the father's flock in Shechem. Now, Shechem was something like about 50 miles, maybe a little more, but at least 50 miles, somebody said the crow flies, north of Hebron or where they were. It's like the fellow ran out of gas and he was coming along asking an old farmer sitting there, says, how far is to the gas station? He said, 5 miles of the crow flies. He said, suppose the crow's walking, how far is it then? That makes a lot of difference, doesn't it? Whether the crow's walking or whether the crow's flying. Well, it was about 50 miles as the crow flies. This, you measure it on the map, shows that. a long distance there. And Israel said unto Joseph, are not thy brethren feeding the flock in Shechem? Come. It's just the same as the pastor said. They are. Come, and I will send thee unto them. And he said to him, here am I. Now, evidently, Joseph doesn't have any particular fear here about going up. I think he had no idea his brothers would do what they did, although he knew the character of these men. He knew something about them. Here am I, very obedient to his father, very respectful. And he said to him, go now, see whether it is well with thy brethren and well with the flock, and bring me word again. So he sent him out of the vale of Hebron and came to Shechem. Now there are three things. Go and see whether it is well with it. Bring me word again. And he came to Shechem and then comes back to them. Go and see and come and report is what he's telling him to do. So from Hebron there was about 50 miles, something like that. And he came to Shechem, and a certain man found him. And behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, what seekest thou? Not who, but what? What are you looking for? As if he were looking for animals. That is straight away. Now, he might have been asking other people if he had seen them. But here the man can see he's looking for something, and for what? And he said, I am seeking my brethren. Tell me, I pray thee, where they are feeding the flock. And the man said, they are departed hence, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. And Joseph went after his brethren and found them in Dothan. Now, Dothan is something like 24 miles on up above Shechem. So this would give you somewhere between 70 and 75 miles. That from home, from Hebron, up to Dothan where he found them. Now, this is a thing that oftentimes, when we don't look up a thing or don't remember it, that we don't consider a distance. To me, when I'm studying something that is geographical, I want to know where it is and how far it is from this place or that place that we are studying. That adds a great deal of interest. Now, you might just read this and think, well, he just had to go over the hill yonder and find out, but he did. It went 75 miles before he got there. That would be about 3 days, wouldn't it? Something like that, if he didn't really hurry. And they saw him afar off. And before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. Now, yonder is afar off, and he's walking. No doubt they could tell by his walk. So often you can tell an individual by his walk, can't you? Yes, a person can see me walking as far as he can see me. Well, he can recognize my walk. They tell me, I don't know. They can walk different than anybody else. Put one foot in front of the other and go right on down. But they used to tell me that. A walk deceived me. Well, all right. Maybe it does. And then maybe had on this coat. So they could detect the coat and they could detect the walk here, and they recognized him. Now note, they conspired against him to slay him. There's a conspiracy here. And they said one to another, behold, this dreamer cometh. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him and cast him into one of the pits, and we will say an evil beast to devour him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. Now Reuben the oldest comes to his defense here, that Reuben had committed a sin that ever probably had made him rather odious in the eyes of some of these brothers, and especially the two sons of the handmaid into whose bed he had gone. Remember, he had committed incest here with his father's wife here, concubine. And Reuben heard it and delivered him out of their hand and said, let us not take his life. And Reuben said unto them, shed no blood. Cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but lay no hand upon him, that he might deliver him out of their hand to restore him to his father. Now, in all of that, his good intentions are marred by deception, aren't they? He's deceiving the brethren. He's going to come back and let's put him there and leave him there. And say a wild beast, but he's going to go back and take him out, let him go on back home. So we appreciate what he intended to do. We can't appreciate his deceptive method of going about it. He ought to have just stood up
and contended for what was right, should he not? We can learn that lesson, to contend for what is right. And it came to pass, when Joseph was come unto his brethren, that they stripped Joseph of his coat, the coat of many colors, that was on him, and they took him and cast him into the pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in an old cistern there, an old place to catch the water out there, but at that time, probably the dry season, no water in it. Now, no, there was no formality about it. When it came, they very roughly took his garment off of him and put him in the pit. That was all. But now, notice how indifferent, callous they are. And they sat down to eat bread. Now, to eat bread is a Hebrew expression for eating a meal there, the breaking of bread or the eating of bread. So, he'll take him as brother and put him in this pit or cistern here, empty cistern. Now, sat down now to eat their meal, indifferent to his feeling and to his hunger or what he may need. A very callous bunch of fellows. And yet God's going to bring his son and his nation a scheme of redemption through them. And they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead. Now, Gilead was to the north, noted for its various types of resins that were used in some of them for perfume and some of them in embalming and some of them for healing. And these men were coming here bearing spice, their camels, bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down into Egypt. Known they called Ishmaelites. And Judah said, now Judah intervenes now, and he's the one that's going to intervene later. Now here are so many things in this section we're studying that really look unto the Christ. There are many things that this, first of all, this chapter, one of the greatest chapters in the Bible, it and verse 39 and 40. One of the greatest sections in the Bible on providence. Divine providence. I think I've mentioned to you before that Brother McGarvey has, in his book of sermons, two very fine sermons on providence. One deals with Esther and the other deals with Joseph. If you have that book, I have access to it, you'll enjoy reading those two very wonderful, splendid sermons. And he takes one of them from Joseph and shows the providence of God in bringing Joseph to the final place that he brings him. But each step is a link in this chain here from just a 17-year-old lad with a coat that aroused the envy of his brethren until after a while he was raised to the place of governor of Egypt and the savior of his family. And so the savior of his family and the savior of the nation, really. Right? That's interesting, the providence of God in that. Then you see him here and the hatred of his brethren, how they try to get rid of him in many ways. Joseph prefigures the Christ. You see many, many points of likeness there. Here his brothers hated him and they sold him thinking that they were rid of him as the Jews said, let's get rid of him, put him to death. Then when he went into Egypt here, how that he was put in prison there. Now here in between, here two thieves, but two fellows here that were in prison here, a butler and a baker. One of them is redeemed and the other one is put to death. Right between two thieves, Jesus died. So many things here that if I think about them, I'll try to call attention to them as I go along here, in which you see similarities between Joseph and the Lord. I think more so than in many other of these Old Testament characters. And yet, he is not the great man that Jacob was, so far as his faith, had a great faith. But Jacob is also great and grew strong. All right, and go and bring me this word here. All right, now then, they put him in the pit. Now here he is sold here. And Judah then intercedes, and later on he intercedes for Simeon. And Simeon is the one that he kept, because Simeon was a hard man. He was a very hard fellow, and I just wonder if he wasn't one of the main ones here, you can't tell. Now he said, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him. for he is our brother, our flesh. That's pretty hard too. Would he be much better off sold down into slavery than he would have been dead before he knew? No. But he thought this was a little bit better anyway, to put sell him down there than to put him to death. But that's hard. And his brethren hearkened unto him. And they passed by Midianites, merchant men, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit, and said, and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph into Egypt. Now it looked like that the Midianites lifted him up, but no, the brethren did. Now I think the Ishmaelites and the Midianites are the same here. Now, of course, they go by this as the Media or Median, and that really goes back, I believe, unto one of Abraham's descendants was that wife he married? Keturah. I think so. I didn't check on it, but I believe that's right. Memory doesn't fail me. But at any rate, I think they were Ishmaelites that were dwelling in the land of Midian. The Midianites weren't, but the Ishmaelites were. The Ishmaelites were descendants of Abraham, but it's called the Midianites also. Well, that's true, if that's so, but that's purely a guess that they dwelt in among the Midianites, because they're called both. And that's the best I'm able to do with it, is that there were actually Ishmaelites by blood dwelling near or in the midst of the Midianites, or as you say, you would address here a man from Mexico, Mexican by blood, as an American. You see, all right? Now, yeah. Could have been, yeah. One of the group of Ishmaelites. Could have been, that's an alternative that I also have read and thought about and should have mentioned. There were two groups of them here. And maybe one group bought them from the brothers and sold them to the other one there. I don't know, but they're either all Ishmaelites who dwelt in Midian or two groups, one or the other. And nobody knows. You can read any all the commentaries in your library, and you still, they don't know either. Sir? No, not a bit in the world. But it was just a question. Well, skeptics made something out of this, yes. Those are theologians that really don't believe the Bible. They make quite an issue out of this. But yeah. Oh, that's right. Oh, yeah. But that is that's not indicated at all. Before they took them. So we know that that's not true. That one group drew him out and sold him to another group. Found him. I know. We know that it's the same bunch of folks, whether Midianites or Ishmaelites or two different groups in the bunch. The same ones that bought him from the brothers. Now the brothers sold him there. That's right. All right. Now then, and he was. And Reuben, and they brought him Joseph into Egypt. And Reuben returned unto the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit. And he rent his clothes. After taking it up here, not tear them all off, but rend a part of it. And he returned unto his brethren and said, the child is not, and I, whither shall I go? Where shall I look for him? What's happened to him? And they took Joseph's coat, and they don't give an explanation. And they took Joseph's coat and killed a he-goat and dipped the coat in the blood. And they sent the coat of many colors. Now, they didn't bring it. They sent it. And they brought it. And they sent the coat of many colors. And they brought it, which seems to indicate they by whom they sent it, to their father and said, this have we found. Yet that sounds like it's the brothers themselves. So I guess it is they. Know now whether it is thy son's coat or not. And he knew it and said, it is my son's coat. And the evil beast had devoured him. So overcome by grief, that it seems that Jacob doesn't really closely examine the coat. If he closely examined the coat, I think he could have detected something there that it had not been torn by an animal. But so completely overcome by grief, and he was, that he didn't examine it, it seems like at any rate, because he said, and Joseph is without doubt torn in pieces. And Jacob rent his garments and put sackcloth upon his loins, something like a gunny sack, rough garment or cloth out of camel's hair, worn next to the body here for in mourning, grief, and mourned for his son many days. Here's something the brethren hadn't thought about, those brothers, and all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, for I will go down to Sheol to my son mourning, and his father wept for him. Now, you'll notice his daughter. He probably had other daughters after Dinah, but they're not mentioned. Or these could have been his daughters-in-law. So it's either one or the other, because I mentioned that the other day, they mentioned earlier his daughters, and they're mentioned here. Or maybe it's later that they're mentioned, but anyway, they're mentioned several times in here. But notice another thing, he refused to be comforted. I go down to Sheol mourning. Now this is the thing the brothers didn't plan on. Well, the old man will get over it. He'll just think somebody killed him. He'll get over it, but he didn't. Every time they saw the old fellow, they could see he was still thinking about Joseph. He was grieving. He was mourning for him. That was always a reminder. Sir? They knew better than that. That's right. And so here they had to bear this guilt with a constant reminder of it, always before them. I don't know, I think, and he refused to be comforted. Now then, verse 36, and the Midianites, called Midianites over here in the Hebrew, sold him into Egypt under Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's, the captain of the guard. Now we come back to the captain.